Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Captain Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Hey, Francis.
How are you this morning?
I'm doing great. You know one of the reasons I'm doing great?
Why is that?
Because I know we're going to continue yesterday's conversation about
The Harry Cipriani review.
Everybody is talking about it.
Everybody's emailing us about it.
They're talking about it in our restaurant. People from other restaurants are talking about it.
Let's fill people in case you weren't listening yesterday. What happened was Harry Cipriani, a very expensive restaurant in the Sherry Netherland Hotel in Manhattan, got a poor review from Frank Bruni of the New York Times. Now, poor is rarely seen. There's 4 stars, 3 stars, 2 stars, 1 star. Satisfactory, which is no stars, and then poor.
Think of if you were in college and there was a grade G right after F. Right. That's basically what poor would be.
Anyway.
Basically, poor is like, well, you showed up and you got everything wrong and you annoyed us.
Right.
Okay,
and
that's basically the grade they got.
It's a negative star if there were such a thing. But here, let's read a little from the review. Now, the Ciprianis
We'd
are not...
We'd rather you were a parking garage.
The Ciprianis are not really nice people. I hope my car doesn't blow up because I said that. But, well, here's how we start the review, and neither did Frank Bruni doesn't think so either. He says, Frank Bruni writes in the New York Times, over the years, the Cipriani restaurant family and its employees have faced charges of sexual harassment, insurance fraud, tax evasion, and the last two leading to guilty pleas by two family members in July. But the crime that comes to mind first when I think of the Ciprianis is highway robbery.
You think they're going to plead guilty to that?
Based on my recent experience, that's what happens almost any time Harry Cipriani on Fifth Avenue serves lunch or dinner.
That's a tough way to start your... Okay.
Wow.
First you read... Poor, okay, minus negative stars. Then you read that, they're all basically criminals, and the worst crime that they're committing is the one to your wallet. Affront to your wallet.
Well, it's in the Sherry Netherland Hotel, and if you'd like to spend $22.95 for asparagus vinaigrette, which is 12 spears of asparagus, roughly $2 a spear, and he's careful to point out that those they don't have any truffles, black truffles, white truffles, Parmesan cheese, nothing, just asparagus. $34.95 for an appetizer of fried calamari.
That's only at dinner time, though.
And a dinner entree of Fritto Misto costs $48.95, even though it amounted to an extra large portion of fried calamari with a few decorative shrimp and token scallops, strewn to negligible effect among the generic calamari. Now, let's point out that Frank Bruni has reviewed very well restaurants that cost this much money.
Yes.
But it's about, you know, what restaurants spend money on now is what goes on the plate, what goes in the dining room.
I want to ask you a question.
Dinner. Yeah.
And I want to ask you a real question about this review. Do you think if those asparagus were $5 and the fried calamari was $10 and the Fritto Misto was $15, that he would have reviewed this differently?
Yeah, I think he probably wouldn't have reviewed the restaurant at all. He would have been, another nondescript, inexpensive restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
I think the reason that this, you know, usually when they find a restaurant that's really not doing anything special, they don't review it at all.
Right.
I think what happened here was he feels a responsibility. The Ciprianis are an important restaurant family, and they are charging people a lot of money.
And they have a busy restaurant.
And they have a busy
restaurant. That a lot of people go to.
Well, what he says is...
I think probably today that fewer people go to than went to before.
Regulars accept that it's the epitome of a restaurant whose steep tariffs justify themselves subbing for membership. What he's saying is it affirms their patrons' ability that they can show each other that they're people who can throw away money. He says regulars accept and revel in this or have bit by bit deluded themselves into believing that the $36.95 spaghetti with tomato and basil has something special to recommend it. Parenthetical, trust me, it does not. But I think he's writing this review for the next paragraph, which is what of the uninitiated New Yorker or innocent tourist who sees the Cipriani name with its connotations of extravagant banquets and extraordinary privilege and waltzes through the doors expecting expecting something magnificent in return for the king's ransom they charge. These victims in the offing deserve a heads up on what they're likely to find, which is service so confused and food so undistinguished it wouldn't pass muster at half the cost. And that, I think, you know what? He's right, and that's why he's written this review. Mm-hmm. That's why he goes out of his way to say bad things about somebody.
He doesn't just go out of his way. It is paragraph after paragraph after paragraph of hammering them.
Okay. You want to talk about the visually the desiccated yellow beige coin for potato that had somehow acquired the texture of Brillo and could almost have been used to scrub whatever pan they'd emerged from?
Brillo's a bad texture for potatoes. I want to ask you a question, and I'm going to go off topic, and then we'll go back to the review in just a second.
Okay.
There's a very good chance that this review of this restaurant will be the opening salvo that puts this restaurant out of business.
Yes.
Is that too much power for one person to have over a restaurant, over any business?
Here's the deal.
Is that too much power?
Here's the deal. I used to think that because there was a time when the Times was it, and there was also the New Yorker, Gal Green at the New Yorker, and there were a couple of publications. I have to be honest. It's the opening salvo. This is the biggest gun, but there are a lot of other guns now, and I'll tell you where it is. So many people have food blogs and food magazines that if Frank Bruni were wrong, and he's not, okay, because I've eaten there, and he's not wrong. But if Frank Bruni were wrong on this, you have New York Magazine could stand up. You have Time Out New York who could stand up. You have Andrea Strong in the blogosphere that could stand up. You have Eater.com. There are lots of people on there that are not professional food critics that would stand up. And there are other voices now. So I think the New York Times is still the most important voice in restaurant reviews in New York, especially of expensive restaurants. But there's a chorus now out
there. So you think if it were untrue that it would not put them out of business?
Yes.
But if it's true, it will probably be the first of the largest and first bullet that will sink the ship.
I think other people have said the same about Harry Cipriani. It's just that this is the widest audience to say what some people have already said about it. So it's not the first, but it is the most damning and justified.
There are a few reviews in my life that I've read that have been like this.
But, you know, I've been at the Cipriani's restaurants, and, you know, I mean, they're the people who took over the Rainbow Room from Joe Baum, and they removed that beautiful, wonderful old bar.
Unbelievable.
And put in some crappy little bar in the corner. And so if you go up to the Rainbow, and again, the Rainbow Room that they changed was nicer before they changed the bar room I'm talking about, not the Rainbow Room itself where you can go dancing. That's still beautiful. But what did they do? They made it a private club.
Mm-hmm.
And when you go up there on the nights when they're open to the public, I still did get the feeling that they were doing me a favor by serving me a $20 glass of champagne. And I thought, you know what? Maybe you make people feel like that, and maybe Frank Bruni's making you feel like
right,
that.
Right, the view isn't that important to me.
Well, and again, I think this review is important, and I mentioned the last time we talked about this. I think the interesting thing here is the emperor has no clothes statement. What he's saying is that these rich people that are going there, and I'll read it again, you rarely see blondness this improbable, cosmetology this transparent, or wealth this flamboyantly misspent. What he's saying is the wealthy people who are going there pretending they're better than everybody else are idiots. Okay, they have no
taste.
They're
actually worse than everybody.
What he's saying is, yeah, you have no taste. You may think you're better than I am because you can spend all this money on the asparagus, but guess what? The asparagus is terrible and you don't even notice because you have no taste.
Mm-hmm.
The question is, will this cause this old school of restaurant to have to either change and become a food-centric restaurant or close? Will it cause these patrons now, who obviously have no taste, to flee? And or is why they're there have nothing to do with the food, and is there room for a restaurant like that still in New York?
I say they flee.
And let's remember, the Ciprianis have a lot of money, and they're not dumb people.
Well, maybe, I think they'll change it.
Maybe it causes them to invest a couple $1 million and make this a great restaurant.
I think they'll
change
it and make it a better restaurant.
We'll be watching for that to happen. I bet they're still going to be mean to you when you go. All right, we'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. It's 11:15. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. And today we're talking with Ben Schott, no relation to me. He is the author of Schott's Original Miscellany, Schott's Almanacs, Schott's Sporting Gaming and Idling Miscellany, and most importantly to us, Schott's Food and Drink Miscellany.
Ben, welcome to the show.
Hi, guys.
Can you explain to our audience who may not, and your book is everywhere over here, can you explain to our listeners what the miscellany is, what it's a collection of?
It's basically a collection of everything that makes me laugh in the library. I have a kind of magpie mind, and I like sort of collecting information and flotsam and jetsam of life, which amuses me. It's as simple as that. I write very selfishly, I'm afraid.
Ben, you're not supposed to laugh in the library, man.
I know. That's the thing. You know it's a good book, or you know, if it inspires the shushing.
Well, you know, now I have to say, Ben and I may be related, though we haven't quite figured out how yet, but Ben spells his last name the same way I do. And I will tell you, Ben, something that is very interesting to me. I'm going to start start a little cottage industry in selling your books.
Because, that would be fantastic.
Well, I actually would be reselling them, because anytime anyone wants to buy me a present and comes across a book written by Ben Schott, they buy it for me. I have 14 copies, and I would like on the air to ask all of my friends to not purchase me any more copies of Schott's Food and Drink Miscellany. I'm giving them all to other people. I'm re-gifting them for Christmas this year, except for the one that I'll keep. Fabulous book. But it's an incredible book. Now, you started this more or less as a lark, right? I mean, it wasn't really meant to be a career.
Absolutely. I was a photographer, specializing in portraits of difficult, ugly people, politicians, and things like that. And one year I thought I would do a little Christmas card. I did Christmas cards each year for my clients. And one year I thought I'd do one as sort of curious information of use for photographers. So paper stock, film sizes, chemicals, lighting temperature. And I thought, my Lord, it really is very, very dull. So I thought I would lighten the load with some sort of curious miscellaneous facts. So like wine bottle sizes, very useful for photographers, of course. And I carried on writing this sort of little collection. And I carried on writing until it became a book. I printed 50 privately, just a joke, as a lark, as you say, and I sent one to a publisher, and 6-8 months later, it was number one in the UK bestseller, and frankly, it's been a bit of a blur since then.
But doesn't everybody need to know the difference between a Jeroboam and a Methuselah as far as their wine bottle
size? Yeah, but photographers, you know, who are obviously, you know, passionate about drinking, you know, they also need to know.
Well, now, your book is since the original book was Schott's Original Miscellany.
Yeah.
But now that book had sold 600,000 copies or something like that. What's the accurate number?
It's probably over 1.5 million now.
Oh my God! And how many
I think it's an 18. I lose count. I think it's about 18 languages. I've just seen the Japanese ones library. There's a Korean one. There's a Cyrillic one. Apart from the obvious, you know, Spanish, Italian, German, French. The French one's just come out. The French food and drink one has just come out. The idea of an Englishman writing to the French about food and drink. But I think it was number 3 last time somebody told me. So clearly they haven't quite figured out how English I am.
Well, now the food and drink miscellany, which is the one that is most often gifted to me, sharing the same name and seemingly a career. People have been, with always the query, are you related to me? Has everything in it from toasts, when to toast, a great quote on when to drink champagne, which I use. I teach wine classes. I use the quote all the time. From, may I read the quote that attributed to Madame Lily de Bollinger? Bollinger is a famous champagne producing family, and there's a quote that's attributed to her, where she says, I drink it when I'm happy and when I'm sad. Sometimes I drink it when I'm alone. When I have company, I consider it obligatory. I trifle with it if I'm not hungry and drink it when I am. Otherwise, I never touch the stuff unless I'm thirsty.
Exactly. And I think Winston Churchill would approve of that line by line.
Now, how do you select what... I mean, the book is infectious. I mean, you know, how do you... You know, people put it in a reference section of a bookshop or a library, but you really can't use it as a reference because there's no way to look up anything useful. You've got to sort of read it through.
When you say miscellany, you mean it.
Without being difficult, there is an index. somebody wrote me a very rude letter saying, how dare I write a book like this without having an index? And I wrote back saying, please see end of book. So you can look things up. And, you know, there are some things that are, you know, reasonably useful. We have, healthy temperatures for fridges and freezers and this kind of thing. But in a sense, I wanted to write a book that people like you, i.e. food experts, would find things they didn't know. And there are lots of, you know, there are huge encyclopedias of cookery and encyclopedias of food and drink, and that's fine. But I wanted to get the footnotes, the curious little bits and pieces, the flotsam and jetsam, as I said, that even foodies, you know, wouldn't know. And it's lovely. I mean, I go to quite a lot of restaurants in New York especially, and the number of chefs who have that and go, oh, this is great. I didn't know this stuff. And I'm sort of vaguely stunned because, you know, it's their job. But actually, I get to delve in the curious old books and to sort of, you know, find, you know, the little gems that maybe haven't hit the public consciousness.
Well, what's funny is you read through this book, and you know, there's a lot of stuff like that Madame Lily de Boulanger quote, which we know. And you think, oh, well, I'm comfortable, I know this. And then you come across something that you don't know, but almost, and here's what I think binds your books together and why they're so fascinating, is because when you read through them, you find all every third fact is something that you say to yourself, oh, I need to remember that. And, of course, you won't. So you have to hold on to the book. But it's those tiny little facts that, you know, how to toast and you know, how to pass a loving cup.
The loving cup.
The loving, it's a great story, loving cup.
We have to take a quick break. We're going to come back after the break and talk with Ben Schott, author of Schott's Food and Drink Miscellany, about just if you're ever at the point where you've won and you need to pass the loving cup, you'll know how to do it. You never know when this might come up, so stay tuned. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. It's 11:25.
Have yourself a merry little Christmas. Let your heart be light.
Vogue magazine calls Jackie Naylor the new voice of jazz. We call her family. Jackie has 6 critically acclaimed albums to her credit, including the brand new Smashed for the Holidays. From the Wall Street Journal to New York Magazine to the Village Voice, the praise is universal. The Restaurant Guys present Jackie Naylor in a champagne New Year's Eve concert at the Crossroads Theater in New Brunswick. Champagne at intermission provided by the extraordinary Lenobe family of champagnes. Dine before or after the show at one of our restaurants right next door. The beautiful new Heldrich Hotel across the street has preferred room rates for our guests, so you don't even have to drive. Spend New Year's Eve with champagne, jazz, great food, and the Restaurant Guys. For tickets, menus, hotel rates, or more information, it's 732-828-4444 or restaurantguysradio.com. Spend New Year's Eve with us.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick, New Jersey. And today we're talking with Ben Schott, author of the many miscellanies, including Schott's Food and Drink Miscellany.
Ben, we promised everybody we'd talk about the loving cup ritual and how it began. Can you tell everybody about that the ritual which is in your book?
Absolutely. Well, I've actually been, I'm a part of an elaborate dining club at my old university in Cambridge, and I've actually passed the loving cup on a number of occasions. It's possible that it dates back to the assassination of King Edward the Martyr in 978, as you will of course know, who was stabbed to death at Corfe Castle while drinking. And to prevent such assaults, there's this very elaborate procedure. Now, if you imagine a loving cup, it's like a big, like a trophy cup, where you grasp with both hands, and it's often filled with black velvet, which is a wonderful combination of champagne and Guinness.
And you can't have your hand on your sword while you're drinking it.
Well, you can't. You have to have both hands to hold it, because it's a huge, great cup and very heavy, so you can't protect yourself. So what happens is, because a very long procedure short, you stand up, the person on your left faces away from you, and the person on your right faces away from you, and then you drink. You then turn to your right. The person to your right then bows to you. You bow back. You hand him the cup. You bow to him. He bows back. He turns around. The person to his left stands up. He bows to him. The other person bows back. The people either side then turn away to protect, and he drinks. And this then goes round and round and round. And this takes a vast amount of time. So the trick is to drink heavily. Otherwise, you stay too sober.
And as long as the person next to you isn't trying to kill you, this works magically.
Yeah. Well, actually, yeah, and of course, you also have to hope that someone hasn't poisoned the cup, in which case you're all in trouble.
You, Ben, I don't want to offend you at all. But you understand why we think you British people are crazy?
No, absolutely. I mean, and I'm not sure about crazy. I think eccentric, maybe.
But, yeah, that's true. That's a much kinder word. But you know, the loving cup. I didn't really think that you drank out of it. As I've never had the occasion. I think that
you clearly don't go to the kind of Rococo dinners that I get invited to.
And he's never won any sporting events, so that's happened.
That's true. I mean, if it's not 9 courses, I simply don't bother turning up.
We just go for a pint glass, and everybody gets their own. Hey, we'll be back after the news talking more with Ben Schott about the various miscellanies and almanacs that he's written, bestsellers in many different languages, and we'll be back after the news. 1450 WCTC, it's 11:30.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Castle Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Today we're talking with Ben Schott. You must have seen the various books by Ben Schott, Schott's Food and Drink Miscellany, Schott's Original Miscellany, Schott's Almanacs in the bookstores. They're wonderful Christmas presents to get around this time of the year. Because my name is Schott, I have gotten 17 of them, so don't buy any more for me. But you can find out more about him and his books and even purchase them on our website, restaurantguysradio.com. Ben, in your book, I'm fascinated with toasting. I've always been fascinated with toasting. And Mark and I belong to a lunch club where, you know, we closed it recently, but every member needs to toast, starting with the newest member. And it can be a rather lengthy process, and I love it. You deal a lot with toasting. You have a section in your book, Brimmers, Bumpers, Buzzes, Backhanders, and Bishops. What's a brimmer and what's a bumper and why do we care? I did not know this.
Well, this is the kind of information that you glean when you go to elaborate dining clubs, as I try to do. A brimmer is a glass that's so full that no wine touches the brim, but the meniscus effect may still allow a few drops to be added. A bumper is a glass that's so full that the wine actually rises in the middle of the glass. And you can test this by placing a tiny bit of cork on the surface of the wine. With a brimmer, the cork will float to the edge. With a bump, it will remain in the center. And, of course, it's all about how to toast. So the customary way to toast is with a bumper of wine. However, the glass must be absolutely full so it doesn't show any what was called daylight between the water and the rim, because it was considered bad manners to toast someone when your glass wasn't entirely full.
That's...
Now, wine, of course, is passed round the table. A backhander is when the wine's clockwise passage is temporarily reversed so you can fill up the glass of the guy to your right, which is frowned upon in some societies. There were all sorts of sort of tricks for making sure that you get enough wine.
Those are my favorite kind of tricks. now you go from there and you include right smack dab in the middle of your book, and you know, something tells me you and I would get along because you include right in the middle of your book cocktail recipes. What prompted you to put cocktail recipes, and how did you choose what cocktails to place in the book? I mean, you only were able to fit a dozen or a couple of dozen cocktails in here. Out of the world of cocktails, how on earth do you choose?
Well, some of them are my favorite. I mean, there is a whole page on the martini, which discusses the whole concept of the martini cocktail and the various variations therein. But the sea breeze, I'm the whiskey sour, I'm a fan of the Bellini, of course, champagne cocktail, cosmopolitan, mint julep. I sort of did some that people would know but wouldn't necessarily know how to make. I mean, there's no point putting the elaborate recipe for a screwdriver. But there are some like the cosmopolitan where you think, oh yeah, no, I do quite like that, but I didn't quite remember how to make it. So some of them I put in because they were obvious but unknown, and some of them I put in because they were rococo and amusing.
Now, and I do like this, that the book is basically, I can see that it's little facts that amuse you, and it amuses us all. And again, there are things that we wouldn't know. I think you talk about British pub signs and why the British pubs are called the various things they're called. Where did you divine this information?
Well, some of them I know, and some of them I look up. I mean, on the whole, this is information I have to go and find. I'm not actually, despite what one might think, a kind of uber geek who, you know, is excellent on quizzes and Trivial Pursuits. Sadly, I'm not. So I actually sort of go out and ask people. So the food and drink miscellany, often it was talking to chefs and talking to wine waiters and actually just going out. There's a very, very charming man who helped me a lot with the wine, because although I drink a lot, I wouldn't claim to be an expert. So it's always good to have a, expert you can turn to. But the pub signs are interesting because often, you walk past them or you live next door to them and you don't quite know the link between, the blue boar was the emblem of the Earl of Oxford. So there were loads of blue boars around, but actually who they're named after, why they're named in the way they are, is something that, you know, people often find quite curious.
I certainly do.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I like that there, it's not just completely about, you know, the different types of foods and things like that. For instance, there is some information here on the appropriateness of spitting food out, or in other words, or not, or the inappropriateness of spitting food out, I should say.
Absolutely. Why don't you take us through that? Yeah.
I was quite keen to write a book about food and drink that wasn't, you know, as I say, all about food and drink. So we have things, as you say, about spitting food out. My favorite entry is on page 132 of your hymn books. I don't know if you have a book in front of you.
We do.
Which is the Bristol stool form chart, which may or may not be the kind of radio-friendly things we can talk about. But put it like this, I thought it was important, if you're going to talk about input with food, also to talk about output. So it was trying to sort of discuss food and drink in a very broad way. So, you know, as you say, everything from toast and grace before meals to smoking and spitting food out.
You know, it reminds me of Margaret Visser is a woman who wrote a book years ago called The Rites and Rituals of Dinner was the subtitle. It was Manners, The Rites and Rituals of Dinner. And she talks about, you know, how different societies, how manners have evolved. The introduction of the fork, for instance, when it became, you know, impolite to stab your dining companion with a knife, or to wear armaments to dinner. And she begins rather shockingly with maybe the most highly ritualized form of dining, with an account of Spanish conquistadors who are watching some of their compatriots being eaten in a cannibalistic ritual by Native Americans, and sort of as they roll the different potty parts down the temple steps. And that's how she begins her book. And she ends with a state dinner at the White House, complete with formal seating charts and formal rules of etiquette. And I think it really is all tied together in that way.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things about food and drink that really sort of, you know, got me excited was what we eat and drink, when we eat and drink, what we don't eat and drink, who we eat and drink with, how much we eat and drink, things we're prohibited from eating and drinking, tell you almost everything you need to know about class, culture, religion, history, society, because everyone eats and drinks, you know, at least three times a day, if they're lucky. And it's a universal, and it's fascinating. I mean, in England, for example, the order in which you put milk into your tea traditionally told you everything you need to know about class. It was very, very below the salt, another food and drink phrase, to put milk into your tea first. And, you know, my great aunt would say, oh, they're very milk in first type people, because putting your milk in first meant that you didn't really have a spoon to stir it, so you would use the pouring of the tea to, you know, automatically stir the milk. So, you know, upper crust, below the salt, so many food and drink terms speak to class and to privilege, because of course, you know, until very recently, and only in, you know, the countries that we are lucky enough to live in, food was complicated and scarce, and only now are we sort of embarrassed by, I mean, you go to a supermarket and in America or in Britain, you can have, you know, 55 different types of rice. So the sheer profusion of choice is new, and that in itself is interesting. But food and drink tell you everything about a class and a culture and a history.
Just explain that to me again. If you were upper class, you would pour your tea, and then the milk goes in after.
Yes.
Why?
And it would be considered sort of common to put your milk in first.
Basically because you can afford a spoon.
Well, essentially. And also, I think it was more rarefied. On the whole, the more elaborate your sort of eating and drinking tactics were, then the posher you were. Upper crust is interesting, the phrase. It's long been slang for the aristocracy, part of the upper crust, and it comes from the tradition of baking bread in large communal ovens. The poor got their bread from the lowest parts of the oven, where it was charred by the coals, whereas the rich literally had the upper crust.
That's fascinating. Well, now, I need to ask your opinion. We're back on the subject of tea for just a moment.
Spend too much time on tea if you're English.
Extended pinky or no?
Sorry?
Extend the pinky or no?
Personally, no. I think that's an act of affectation.
A bit of feet.
I think it basically depends on the size of the cup.
Yeah, and the size of the size of your finger.
Yes.
I think essentially, one might define good manners and good etiquette is anything that does not draw attention to yourself. So slurping, spitting, scratching parts of your body, throwing bread rolls at your guests, extending your pinky, anything that, that causes people to notice or observe the eating and drinking, I think would be considered infradig and definitely below the salt.
Fascinating. We're talking with Ben Schott. One of his many books is Schott's Food and Drink Miscellany, and we'll be back to talk about the origins of humble pie, and we'll see if you should eat some. WCTC 1450, the time is 11:45.
I think it's great that more and more restaurants are offering larger selections of wine by the glass. Unfortunately, I often find those by the glass wines flat or spoiled. It's been my experience that most wine preservation systems just don't work. Until now. The Vinfinity system was invented by Armando Luis, a mechanical engineer with over 25 years experience in the wine industry. Vinfinity has 3 U.S. patents, but it's so simple I could kill myself for not inventing it first. Vinfinity creates a precise vacuum in the bottle that preserves the wine. Too much vacuum or too little and the wine is damaged. Vinfinity never needs gas and requires little maintenance. One Vinfinity system preserves any number of wines. We use just one system for both of our restaurants, and we're not alone. Some of the best restaurants in the country are taking on the Vinfinity system. The guest gets a large selection of wines by the glass in great condition, and the restaurant eliminates waste. Tell your favorite restaurant about it. If you own a restaurant, install it. Find out more at VinfinitySystem.com or call 201-988-5953.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Captain Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick. We're talking with Ben Schott about his various miscellany books. You can find out more about them through our website, restaurantguysradio.com. They make wonderful Christmas gifts. Ben, you talked about upper crust and the origins of upper crust. What about the origins of humble pie?
Well, eating humble pie is the proverbial, traditional proverbial method of abasing yourself or showing contrition. But, of course, humble pie actually was a dish. Humbles or numbles refers to venison offal, possibly deriving from the old French term for deer entrails, nombre. And there's a recipe in a 1660 book called The Accomplished Cook by Robert May that actually tells you how to make humble pie, and we include that in the book on page 60, because if you really want to show how sorry you are, you're not only expressive, you can always cook it for the person to whom you're apologizing.
And you would bring them humble pie.
Quite right. Literally.
What I love about your book is that you can, on one page, teach me how to do the Heimlich maneuver, and on the very next page, discuss the Japanese tea ceremony.
Absolutely. Two polar opposites in physical activity. I have to say, there's one footnote, which I'm not sure if you stumbled across. It is literally a footnote. I've just seen it on page 61, opposite humble pie. There's a little chart of what things taste like, because I was always tired of people saying everything tasted like chicken. So I went to some old 19th century explorers, went through their notebooks, because they ate everything, because A, they were bearded, strange people who liked that kind of thing, and B, they were hungry. And so we discovered that armadillo tastes of rabbit, and baby wasps taste of scrambled eggs, and sea slugs taste of the green fat of turtle, and termites taste of lettuce, bizarrely. The one footnote, which I think you might enjoy, is I discovered that Portuguese settlers in Africa during the 19th century were permitted to eat hippopotamus meat during Lent. And this was based on the somewhat tendentious ecclesiastical logic that since hippos spent so much time in water, they could be technically classified as fish.
Tremendous. Now, one of the things that you talk about in various forms, whether it's halal or kosher or just general Western etiquette, what are some of the interesting things you found outside of religious prohibitions that people don't eat or are prohibited from eating, and why is that?
Well, I have to say, they tend to be religious. I mean, often, you know, there are, you know, vegans and vegetarians and macrobiotics, and of course, there are people who, you know, this new notion of locavores, which are people who try to eat only food that is grown or sourced in their local environment because of the worry about food miles. On the whole, though, they tend to be religious and they tend to be cultural. But what's interesting is, you know, if you look at halal and you look at kosher, you realize that essentially they are very, very similar sort of sets of food prohibition.
Yeah, It's interesting to see them because I don't know the kosher prohibitions other than how they affect me at the restaurant. But it was interesting to see the scripture that actually prohibited them and to take it down to its source. So,
well, yes, I mean if you go back to the Bible, you realize, and this is a very interesting debate, and I would not claim to be a biblical or Talmudic scholar, but there's a very interesting debate as to why these animals are prohibited, but they were just thought unclean. There is one theory that may be a kind of post hoc justification that, in the desert eating shellfish was probably not a very wise idea. And, obviously, pork has problems. And again, so does uncooked chicken. So it's very interesting to look at the history and say, well, why were these strictures created? And I'm not entirely sure anyone's certain.
Well, I'm sure some of them were to keep their constituency alive.
quite possibly. Although, I don't know. I'm slightly suspicious about that because it seems like a very 20th century. Well, it's all about health and safety, and let's ban trans fat. Has the trans fat prohibition hit New Jersey?
Not really.
Yeah,
not
it's coming. Yeah. If it hasn't come yet, it's coming.
How about foie gras? Are you serving that? Are you allowed to?
Oh, we're still serving foie gras.
We're battling that. We're battling that battle every day to be able to serve foie gras. But yeah, it was proposed by one legislator, and it was resoundingly beaten back. And we think we were partially responsible for that. So,
well, good for you.
Now, I want to ask you, Ben, just about how this has changed your life. I mean, you put this together as a lark. Some years have gone on, and you're quite the celebrity. I mean, your book's in many languages. You have many different books. It looks, from reading your books, they look like a lot of fun to produce. How's this changed your life?
Well, I would say I'm not a celebrity at all. I would do almost anything to avoid being a celebrity. It changed my life. Well, in a sense, I get to sort of go out and hunt through libraries. I mean, it's a very, very lovely job because, as I said earlier, I write selfishly and I kind of write to amuse myself. I don't want to read a book that someone has sort of cynically written for someone else. Who likes a song written by committee or, a poem written by someone who's trying to please someone else? You've got to write for yourself. And so that means I can, wander around the bookshelves and talk to experts in almost any field and just find the things that interest me. So that's the kind of joy of these books, I think.
Well, they're wonderful books.
Very fun to read, I have to say.
My favorite is Schott's Food and Drink Miscellany. You also have a couple of almanacs out. You came out with just recently the 2008 almanac.
That's right, Schott's Miscellany and Almanac, which is a much bigger, much more serious book in some ways. It tells you all about everything you need to know about the year. There is some food and drink. We discuss trans fats. We discuss Uncle Ben's promotion as a spokes character. I'm not sure this has hit you. Uncle Ben has been promoted. You'll be very glad to know. We talk about, some of the best restaurants in the world, not to mention some of the horrors of E. coli and the contamination of food. So, it's a book about the year, everything from pop to politics and gossip and geopolitics. So, Schott's Miscellany in the shops.
Well, you can find it out through our website. You can find it where you can also see them in every bookstore around. Any book by Ben Schott is worth reading, and I'll warn you, once you pick them up, you can't put them down. Hey, Ben, thanks for being on the show. It's been
lovely.
Thanks
so much, Ben.
It's a pleasure. Thanks, guys.
We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. The time is 11:55. Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. Ben Schott's books, fascinating. Can't put them down. And you think you can, but, 25 minutes goes by, you're standing in the bookstore reading about...
You can always tell when Francis really likes a guest and likes the show because I don't get to get a word in edgewise. He's just like, oh, and what about this? And what about that?
Well, what's funny? The truth about this is I read these things and I do remember some of them. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you something, in our business, you talk to a lot of people. I guess it's the way my personality is. Having these little dribbles of trivia comes in very handy and it moves conversation along. I find it amusing. And the thing is, if you find something amusing, then you're amusing when you tell it.
And the beauty of it is it's usually just a paragraph or two paragraphs on a subject. It's not like you need to study it in depth. Just some little tidbit that's pulled out of some other bigger volume.
I read a bunch of the early press on Ben's books, and mm-hmm. they say This is the sort of book that was intended for the loo, but makes its way out into the coffee table.
I read the same thing. But it's one of those things that Francis is absolutely right. You just you start to read it and you can't put it down. I mean, I've been leafing through it through the entire show, just kind of like, oh yeah.
Okay. So you can't get a word in edgewise because I'm talking too much.
Because I was actually reading.
You're reading. Why don't you just go get a cup of coffee? You know,
I was considering that.
I'll handle the show, Mark. You go get a cup of coffee. Well, you know, but if you're a bartender or someone who speaks to people a lot, or if you're a person who has difficulty making conversation,
or if you're just one of those guys who likes to know something that nobody else knows.
Well, it's not about one-upsmanship. It's about, you know, it's a fun fact. But if you're the type of person who has difficulty making conversation, I got a cooking for you.
That's not you.
We only have a moment. No, that's not me. There is an old pickup trick that was detailed in, I don't know, Time Out Magazine's Love issue about 2 years ago. And what it said was, you go to one of those bars that has a bookshelf, but bring your own book and plant it. And so you can be browsing and you can strike up a conversation and open that book and just open and say, oh, did you know that this Ben Schatz books are perfect.
It is a perfect plant book for that moment.
So if you want to pick somebody up in a bar that has a bookshelf or in a bookstore, bring your own book. Make it Ben Schatz's book.
You're just plugging his book because he's got the same last name as you.
I know. Well, I do like that. I don't think there's any relationship. Anyway, but nobody in the restaurant in the radio land cares at all. So why don't we end the show then? I hope you've enjoyed the hour listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schatz.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys. 1450 WCTC. The time is 12 noon.